From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. One of the many disturbing hallmarks of police brutality aimed at protests against police brutality are the attacks on journalists. Police in cities across the country appear to be refusing to distinguish between protesters and clearly identifiable journalists covering the protests. On the one hand, this represents a chilling violation of press freedom. On the other hand, journalists are now more sympathetic than ever before to the victims of police violence and the demands of Black Lives Matter. My guest is Alicia Bell, News Voices Organizing Manager with Free Press. Welcome to the program, Alicia.
Hi, Sonali.
Have you been shocked by what you've seen with journalists being arrested, beaten, and violently attacked? One of the earliest instances we saw was CNN reporter Omar Ramirez being arrested on live television with his entire crew. He was so shocked that he could barely believe what was happening.
Absolutely. I think following Omar's arrest over the weekend, there were several different protests and uprisings happening across the country. And as those protests were happening, there was also a continuing barrage of arrests and assaults on journalists. And it was shocking. You saw police shooting directly at journalists with wooden pellets and rubber bullets. You saw people getting arrested. You saw journalists being pushed into buildings or being shoved into doors and told not to come out. And it was shocking. I think that was the first response was, what's happening? Why is this happening? And then if you take a pause, then the next piece was, of course, this is happening. Because if police are violating the First Amendment, which they are doing when they suppress protesting, then of course they're going to be violating the First Amendment when they are targeting journalists. So it was both a shock and then also yes, this makes sense.
Right. I mean, it's sort of a rule of thumb in even, say, war zones on a global level, that when you have a journalist who's, you know, clearly marked, they might be wearing a brightly colored vest or, you know, carrying a giant camera, wearing a identification badge on their person, that they're there as observers, as witnesses to document what's happening. Factually, as it is happening, and that generally those that are battling one another leave the journalists alone to do their jobs, unless, of course, they specifically target them for doing their jobs. Here in the United States, we're seeing, perhaps for the first time in a long time, what seems to be a clear trend. I think what's disturbing is that it's not just one department or another. From Minneapolis to Los Angeles to New York to Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, police are targeting and attacking journalists. And I mean, obviously, there's no necessarily national, police chief on high sending memos to police departments. But do you think this is a tacit understanding among police departments that journalism is part of the problem?
Well, there may not be a police chief on high that is ordering this assault on journalists, but I certainly think that when you look at the different things that Donald Trump has been saying and calling the press the enemy of the people, talking about fake news for the past 4 years at least, he does play this role of this police chief on high who is giving this order to people across the country, to police officers, to sheriff's departments, to ICE officers, all different folks across the criminal justice system.
I think that's such an important point, because not only does Trump embrace the police, he in the past has, you know, even said out loud things like the police should feel free to be rough with their arrested suspects. But then he's also very clearly stated that press and journalists are the enemy of the people, as he's called them. He particularly likes to target female journalists, in particular female journalists of color at the White House. He picks on them, targets them, challenges them, taunts them. And this it certainly seems to send a message, I suppose, to police, to the police unions, that it's open season on journalists as it is on protesters.
Absolutely. And the way that he's been encouraging militarization, encouraging suppression of protests, encouraging the return to law and order, it makes sense that the police and that the people trying to quell these protests are going to use any means necessary to do so. And so if journalists are uplifting voices of community members who are trying to build and transform their community, then it makes sense that they would try to quell their voices as well.
Another aspect of what we've seen just in the past couple of weeks are internal battles within news outlets. And we're talking about the most established and well-respected of them, the New York Times, whose editor James Bennett recently resigned after internal and external pressure because he enabled the publication of an op-ed by Senator Tom Cotton that basically called on the military to wage war against its people. Even Michelle Goldberg, you know, not the most progressive writer in the New York Times, denounced Cotton's op-ed as fascist. With his stepping down, do you think that reflects a cultural shift within newspapers? And it wasn't just the New York Times. Writers and journalists and editors from the Washington Post and other media outlets were also aghast at the publishing of Tom Cotton's op-ed, leading to James Bennett's resignation.
And I do think it reflects a culture shift. You see that at the New York Times and then in local news in Philadelphia with the Philly Inquirer. You see leaders stepping down, former leaders stepping down as a result of Black journalists organizing with each other and writing letters and taking action. And I think in addition to them resigning and leaving and stepping down, reflecting a culture shift, one of the things that's really encouraging is that you're seeing journalists organizing more than they have visibly organized in the past. And previously, you might have heard journalists say things like, well, we don't participate in advocacy, or we are not organizers or advocates. But at some point, you can't help but be an advocate for yourself. And so it's been really encouraging to see that culture shift happening in newsrooms, where journalists are beginning to be more visible with their organizing and building amongst each other to make change and make transformation in these newsrooms.
Right. I mean, we're certainly seeing journalists of color speak up because they not only see and perhaps can personally relate to how people are victimized, non-journalists are victimized by the police, but they also see the silence of their editors and the sort of silent ways in which editors shape coverage, right? Because police have for so long enjoyed a not just legal immunity, but that sort of cultural immunity that gets expressed in our media, that, you know, if the police spokespeople said that this person was killed because they were resisting arrest, then that needs to be emphasized, that this is the official police line has generally been emphasized. And I'm wondering if you think that because, as I said in the intro, because journalists are now finding themselves victimized like non-journalists, that they can see for themselves, maybe these Black Lives Matter folks have a point.
Absolutely. I hope that's the case. And I hope
not that we ever want journalists to be attacked. I mean, I'm a journalist. I really wouldn't want to be attacked. But
sure. Yeah. We can hope that's the case, right? That what's happening is that folks are beginning to see themselves and people who, and protesters and community organizers and advocates who maybe they wouldn't have seen themselves in before, and seeing themselves in solidarity. I think you also, some of the same complaints and frustrations that people are voicing in these protests, right? People are talking about, they're not just talking about police brutality, they're also talking about economic injustice, they're talking about people's voices and communities being silenced. That's the same thing that journalists of color, especially Black journalists, have been facing for such a long time. So much economic injustice towards Black journalists, not being able to have access to the same positions, the same wealth. You also see that silencing of voices. And that silencing of communities and of story ideas and story pitches. And so I think as communities are talking more and more about economic injustice and silencing and the extraction of power, It reflects what has happened and what continues to happen to Black journalists in newsrooms.
Speaking of Black journalists in particular, on Tuesday, Wendy Thomas, a Black journalist who has covered police, wrote a very interesting and lengthy article in ProPublica saying the police have been spying on Black reporters and activists for years. I know because I'm one of them. So she talks about the longer trend of police surveillance of journalists, but not just all journalists, Black journalists in particular. I feel like this is an aspect of this story around racial justice and racist police violence that we haven't heard very much about, but is so important because for years, activists have demanded that newsrooms look like the communities that they cover. But if those people in the newsroom that are journalists of color are specifically targeted by authorities in an unfair way, then it sort of, you know, that's a part of the story that needs attention, right?
Absolutely. And that conversation around surveillance and around privacy is so key and has been such a common thread throughout movements and movements for civil rights and for social justice for so long that it makes sense that it would permeate different aspects of our culture. And so one of the things that protesters and community organizers and movement builders have been saying for so long is that the government is spying on you. There are folks who have to do security trainings, people take security steps to try to minimize that. But you can only minimize it so much. And so it does make sense that if there have been surveillance programs and privacy rights being denied, and that has disproportionately targeted Black and Brown folks in this country, then it is also true that it would disproportionately impact Black and Brown journalists. And so I think that is another place where there are opportunities for solidarity and for learning, because movement builders and community organizers have been doing a lot of thinking for a long time around how to minimize the impacts of surveillance and privacy. So there is a lot that can be shared and learned from journalists and from movement builders and other capacities around how to minimize the impact of that surveillance and that privacy so that everyone can get the work done that they need to do.
The journalist in question who wrote the piece in ProPublica ended up having to sue the city of Memphis over the police targeting of her and spying of her in particular. It is, of course, so critically important to challenge journalists being targeted, right? Because if journalists are being directly targeted, it sends a chill. It has a chilling impact. Newsrooms might hesitate to send their journalists to the front lines to cover these protests. You and I might speak from the mountaintops about what's happening in protests, but if the big corporate media outlets like CNN or the New York Times aren't sending their journalists and putting their coverage on the front pages and highlighting them in their news reports, it's not going to have the same impact. We're seeing this public cultural shift in the country because of really in-depth and broad news coverage. So I know that the ACLU is suing police departments that have deliberately targeted journalists. Is it critically important for us to speak out for journalists to be protected?
Yes, absolutely. I think that it's true. The majority of people historically and now are not actually on the streets or on the front lines or participating in protest in that very visceral physical way, partially because people have different roles to play in a protest, people have different roles to play in a social movement, but partially because there are so many people who are not connected to organizing and political movements themselves. And so for those people are, that's my grandmother, that's some of my neighbors, that's some of my family members, right? For those people, what they see on the news, what they read about, what they hear on the radio is so key for getting them correct information. And there have been several times already where I've had to correct information for family members and for neighbors and other relatives around the protests that are happening right now. But part of the way I've been able to do that is by showing them video that was taken by journalists, or showing them, or having them listen to audio that was provided by journalists. And so if that doesn't exist, if that video, if that audio doesn't exist, then it is harder to show people the truth and to keep them informed, because there are so many forces, the folks who want to quell these protests, who are perpetuating misinformation and disinformation. And so sometimes people just really have to see it for themselves. And so I think in that way, you also see more and more protesters, more and more people on the streets who are stepping up to do recording themselves and to try to do as much of that as they can. But there's an entirely different capacity that a newsroom has to take video and to take audio and to report on these stories for a broader public.
I can't remember the number of times I've said even the Washington Post or even CNN is reporting that, you know, this, that, or the other, to make a point to somebody who's skeptical and who doesn't take progressive news outlets seriously. But of course, these corporate media outlets and some of the journalists that work in them are not innocent. I remember, of course, and you, I'm sure, remember as well, when Mike Brown was killed in Ferguson, the New York Times tweeted its profile of Mike Brown using the words "no angel," and there was this huge pushback from social media users. And I'm wondering if you think that part of the sea change that we're seeing in public opinion, which is linked to the way in which journalism has changed in its coverage of police brutality, is the result of ordinary people, Black Twitter and others, holding corporate journalism accountable, pushing back on claims that media outlets make?
Yes, 100%. Just in the past few days, you've seen a rise of the hashtags of Fox News is racist or Tucker Carlson is racist.
Right, Fox News is a whole nother thing. But yeah.
Absolutely. And so for people who don't know what that means, or they don't know who that is or what they're talking about, they're going to look into it. And that does create the same kind of culture shift that good journalism creates. And so I do think that there is a shift happening there. I think there's still more room to go. You still see folks referring to protests as riots, for example, and you still see some victim blaming happening with protesters when police begin being violent. There's some blame being placed on protesters for creating violent protests when in fact it was the police who incited violence. And you still see some places where journalists and newsrooms are prioritizing voices of local government or city government or police departments instead of prioritizing the voices of their communities that they represent and the communities that are on the ground. So there is definitely still more room to go, but I do think you see a shift in that narrative and you see more pushback and more resistance and people feeling like they have ways to push back against narrative and the narrative the newsrooms create.
Now, mainstream corporate journalism has for far too long prided itself on their definition of objectivity, which is we just report on the facts, we'll let the consumers of our news make their own decisions. But given the era of, you know, white supremacy / fascism that we seem to be living in under Donald Trump's presidency, I am noticing a little bit more journalist pushback on covering these matters objectively. There's a history, right? Should journalists have been neutral when it came to coverage of Nazi Germany? In retrospect, we realize, no, fascism should be denounced even by journalists. So it seems as though today, when you have someone like Senator Tom Cotton's op-ed, which clearly pushes the line of, you know, demanding an unconstitutional war on a government's war on its own people, it seems journalists are realizing you kind of have to take a stand when it comes to something that borders on fascism. You have to take a stand, and that's kind of a good thing, right?
It is. And I think it's important to recognize, to remember that the concept of objectivity is a newer concept, right? That in the history of journalism in the United States, there hasn't always been this prioritization and kind of worship of the objective word or of objectivity. A lot of that has been tied up in the way that values have been, or ethics have been defined. And a lot of those values and ethics have been defined because of white supremacy by white folks, by white men, specifically. And so I think in this shift and transformation that's happening right now, it would make sense for people to start questioning, where did this ethic come from? Where did this value come from? Does this value serve me or my newsroom or my community? If journalism is meant to speak truth to power, that is a stance. If journalism is meant to inform communities, that is a stance. Because there are so many people lobbying against communities being informed. They're defunding education, libraries, etc. So just wanting to inform a community truthfully is taking a stance and resist that concept of objectivity. And I think the piece around narrative is key too, because as more journalists are recognizing their role in creating cultural narrative and creating political narrative and creating culture, then they have to be thinking about, what is the culture I'm trying to create here? What is that political narrative that I want to be complicit in or not? And so that gives some questions to really reckon with.
Finally, I'm wondering if you see this moment that we're in as analogous to a little bit of what we saw with the hashtag MeToo movement, that, you know, it's taken so many years to diversify newsrooms. And we're not even nearly close to parity in terms of righting historical wrongs or even population representation. But there are more women in newsrooms. There are more people of color in newsrooms than before because of the demands of grassroots activists and people of color. And when the hashtag MeToo movement burst onto the mainstream scene, a big part of it was women journalists taking the lead. And I'm wondering if you're seeing that analogy with journalists of color also being partly responsible for a different approach to these protests we're in.
Absolutely. It's a really heartening and really encouraging to see Black journalists who are really taking a lead and pushing back against some of the harmful traditions and harmful values of journalism. I've even seen more journalists asking questions about whether journalism is complicit in white supremacy. I've seen more journalists talking about the Kerner Commission of 1968 and the Chicago Commission of 1919. Those were commissions, state-sponsored commissions, that said journalists play a role in racial injustice, and journalists play a role in the movements that people have to build. And so as I've seen people kind of churning and thinking through and trying to create something new, it's been exciting because I think you're seeing this push past diversity, this push past equity even, to say, how do we change these systems and these institutions? And maybe even, what does it look like to have repair and reconciliation and healing? And what does media reparation look like to figure out how we move forward? And that is exciting and heartening to see and to hear.
Alicia, give out the website for your organization, Free Press.
It's freepress.net is the website.
And we'll link to that from our website. Thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest has been Alicia Bell. She is the News Voices Organizing Manager with Free Press. We've been discussing journalism and the police protests and how journalists are covering them, but also being targeted by police. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.